Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion, co-sponsored by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Our speaker is Kenneth Reinhardt, Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at UCLA. Professor Reinhardt's lecture is titled Psychoanalysis and the Monotheistic Origins of Modern Science. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, David Eckel, professor of religion and director of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion.
Tonight we welcome Professor Kenneth Reinhardt from the Department of English and Comparative Literature at UCLA. Professor Reinhardt received his PhD from Johns Hopkins in English and American Literature in 1989. His special interests include the history of critical and aesthetic theory, contemporary critical theory, psychoanalysis, philosophy, political theory, and Jewish studies, especially hermeneutics and modern Jewish philosophy. He's the author, with Slavoj Žižek and Eric Santner, of The Neighbor, Three Inquiries in Political Philosophy. Let's repeat that again. Slavoj Žižek. That's one of these marvelously unpronounceable names that populates our field, Slavoj Žižek, a name certainly to be conjured with. And he also is a co-author with Julia Reinhard Lupton of After Oedipus, Shakespeare in Psychoanalysis, as well as articles on Freud, Lacan, Levinas, Henry James, Jewish Studies, and the Bible. I saw the name Henry James on my list, and I almost thought Henri James, since we are so much in the French world, but no, it is actually Henry James. I understand from Michael Zank that he is a lively and engaging lecturer. I'm looking forward very much to hearing what he has to say on the topic of psychoanalysis and the monotheistic origins of modern science. Please join me in welcoming Professor Reinhardt.
Thank you so much, David, and thank you also to the Institute for Philosophy and Religion for inviting me to come out and make this presentation. Okay, for Freud, the question of where psychoanalysis stands in relation to religion, science, and philosophy was clear. As a continuation of the project of enlightenment, psychoanalysis was on the side of science, usually allied with philosophy, and almost always against religion. Freud's medical education included study in the newly developing synthesis of biology and physics associated with the Berlin Physikalist Society, led by Hermann Helmholtz and Ernst Brucke. Helmholtz's dynamic theory of energy as subject to displacement and transformation, but fundamentally indestructible, would be key to Freud's account of libido and his early understanding of the dynamic relationship of conscious and unconscious aspects of mind. Freud fully expected that in time, all the discoveries of psychoanalysis would be corroborated and established on a quantitative foundation as modern science unfolded from the Copernican turn represented by Galileo's mathematization of astronomy and physics. Freud also explicitly connected psychoanalysis with the second Copernican turn, announced by Kant's critical philosophy, which on the one hand bracketed both theological and rationalist beliefs and knowledge through revelation or pure reason, and on the other hand criticized empiricist attempts to define knowledge in terms of direct perception. Like Kant, Freud insisted that science needed to take the fact of subjectivity into account. But whereas for Kant this meant describing the transcendental structure of the subject, for Freud, the subject is always a singular conjunction of individual and phylogenetic history. As a modern science, psychoanalysis would take its cue from Nietzsche and Darwin and expand in parallel with developments in modern physics and biology, as well as research in the social and cultural sciences. Freud, for the most part, saw religion as an illusion, developed through the projection of infantile wishes onto and beyond nature, and the concomitant belief in a metaphysical world where God the Father makes up for the deficiencies of our all-too-human actual mothers and fathers. Freud was also painfully aware that religion was often the lens through which aggressivity was focused onto outsiders and scapegoats, such as the Jews. and he was sensitive to what he perceived as the hypocrisy of Christian universalism. Yet, he remained fascinated by religion and continued to regard it as a powerful source of information about the primitive structures of mental life and social organization. His last great work, Moses and Monotheism, moreover, goes beyond the project of cultural interpretation or ideological critique of religion, and through the clinical technique he calls construction, attempts to intervene in collective fantasy. Now, for Freud's great follower, Jacques Lacan, the question of the relationship of psychoanalysis to religion, science, and philosophy remains central. Although Lacan makes it clear that, like Freud, he's an atheist, Lacan's understanding of the role of religion in the history of the subject is quite different from Freud's. Lacan was influenced by the work of Alexandre Coiré, the Russian-French philosopher of science, who argued that the crucial role of monotheism in the development of scientific thinking was the Torah's account of creation as a necessary step in breaking with the closed universe of the pagan world. For Lacan, Judaism and Christianity not only represent symptoms of both civilization and its discontents, but also constitute historical cuts that led to the emergence of a type of subjectivity specific to science, and in turn necessary to the possibility of psychoanalysis. In his essay, Science and Truth, which I understand some of you have read, Lacan insists that the central point is not whether psychoanalysis is a science, but, quote, the fact that its practice implies no other subject than that of science, close quote. For Lacan, the concept of a subject of science is not the claim that psychoanalysis should aspire to the condition of science, but raises the question of its implications for science. That is, what sort of science would be able to accommodate the discoveries of psychoanalysis? The discovery in particular of the intimate relationship between our bodies and language in what Lacan calls jouissance. Moreover, Lacan makes the surprising claim that the subject of science addressed by psychoanalysis is no other than the Cartesian cogito, the kicking boy of self-consciousness for contemporary anti-humanist French philosophy. Lacan's understanding of the relationship of psychoanalysis to science evolves over the course of his career. If earlier in his thinking, Lacan sees the work of psychoanalysis as a process of formalization, reduction to essential structures expressed in quasi-mathematical terms or mathemes, in his later work, he argues that the transformative work of psychoanalysis depends on the encounter with impasses in formalization and the remnants of the real that are left over from symbolization, bits of traumatic enjoyment or jouissance. Whereas he often summarized his thinking in the 1960s in the aphorism, the first one on your handout, a signifier represents the subject for another signifier, in the 1970s, the enigmatic formulation, there's no such thing as a sexual relationship, dominates his discourse. For Lacan, the concept of the impossibility of the sexual relationship first emerges in monotheism's originary break with pagan cosmology. In returning to that historical cut and its later reinflection in the cogito, psychoanalysis establishes the terms for its practice and its reconceptualization of modern science. So my talk today is an attempt to show what Lacan's argument is about the emergence of science from monotheism and how psychoanalysis depends on and transforms the idea of science. Of course, these are highly complicated and interconnected issues, so please consider these remarks more of an introduction with examples rather than a definitive statement. Lacan elaborates on Coiré's argument already in 1960 in the session of his Seminar 7, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis, entitled On Creation Ex Nihilo. Modern science, the kind that was born with Galileo, could only have developed out of biblical Jewish ideology and not out of ancient philosophy or the Aristotelian tradition. The increasing power of symbolic mastery has not stopped enlarging its field of operation since Galileo. In other words, the vault of the heavens no longer exists, and all the celestial bodies appear as if they could just as well not be there. Their reality, as existentialism puts it, is essentially characterized by their facticity. They are fundamentally contingent. Now, in Lacan's reading of Coiré, God's creation of the universe through speaking means the introduction of a signifier in all of its properties. First of all, this implies that the world as created could just as easily not have been created. The monotheistic event of creation introduces contingency into the world, which no longer can be regarded in terms of the necessity that governs the classical cosmic order. Creationism is the denaturalization of nature, which, by this originary gesture, is increasingly subject to symbolic mastery by speaking human beings. This combination of contingency and symbolization in creation ex nihilo characterizes the structure of the signifier as such, which is indeed contingent or, as Saussure says, arbitrary and conventional. In the Hebrew Bible, however, God does not create the world from nothing, but from primal chaos, tohu vabohu. The nothing only emerges as the final act of creation. Contrary to popular assumptions about the 7 days of creation, God did not have a six-day work week and then knocked off for the Sabbath. Rather, the Bible says that God finished his work on the seventh day and then rested. So what did he make on the seventh day? According to the rabbis, God made rest, which is thus not just the stopping of work, but an act of making, a kind of subtractive poesis, if you will. That is, creation ex nihilo is not creation from out of nothing, but creation of nothing, the production of a gap of rest that, rather than completing creation, we might say decompletes it. Recall, too, that in Lurianic Judaism, God's creation begins through the subtractive process of tzimtzum, God's reduction or contraction of himself in order to make room for creation. In Seminar 7, Lacan describes the structural gap introduced by the signifier through the familiar biblical allegory of God as the potter and his creation as the pot, which is many places Isaiah 64 for one. Lacan says, "The potter, just like you to whom I am speaking, creates the vase with his hand around this emptiness, creates it just like the mythical creator, ex nihilo, starting with a hole. The fashioning of a signifier and the introduction into the real of a gap or hole are identical." In emphasizing God's speech act of creation as a contingent act of the production of a void, Lacan here defines the origins of modern science around a nascent theory of the signifier. The inaugural gesture of science, then, is neither empiricism nor symbolization in the sense of finding meaning in the natural world. But on the contrary, science requires the introduction of the signifier as something that is not, that exists only as difference and through no necessity. We can understand this in terms of the concept of the variable, developed by Descartes and other mathematicians in the 17th century. According to Lacan, quote, "Logic has come to the point of confronting something that supports a reference to truth when it produced the notion of a variable," close quote. In order for there to be science, the world must be understood not as full of meaning, which is indeed the nature of the pagan cosmology, but as full of signifiers. And this in turn assumes that it is structured by the lack or self-difference which the signifier brings with it. Lacan expands on this point in his Seminar 13, The Object of Psychoanalysis. "The Jewish enunciation that God made the world from nothing is, properly speaking, as Coiré taught and wrote, what opened up the path to the object of science. People have become bogged down or remain stuck on all sorts of qualities, whatever they may be, force, impulsion, color, anything you wish. In short, to perception, to the piece of chalk to which Socratic progeny remain stuck like flies on flypaper for 2,000 years. The piece of chalk becomes an object of science from the moment that you begin from this point, which consists in considering it as lacking. The science that begins with Aristotle and that will guide philosophy through the Middle Ages is based on a logic of predication, in which things are assumed to have attributes that are available to us via sensory perception. According to Lacan, however, the essence of modern science does not lie in its description, for example, of the properties of a piece of chalk, which is probably a reference to a passage from Plato's Phaedo, but in the possibility of the chalk not being there. This is an extension of the notion of the linguistic signifier as based on lack into a concept of the object as based on its own absence. To be an object for modern science, a thing must be understood as potentially not there. Lacan clarifies this by referring to an amusing parable of the principle of the conservation of energy proposed by Richard Feynman. In Feynman's story, Dennis the Menace, who I assume some of you still remember from daytime kids' TV shows and comic books, Dennis the Menace has 28 indestructible identical blocks. Every day, his mother puts him in a room with his blocks, and every evening she counts the blocks to see if they are all there. One day she counts only 27 blocks, but she soon discovers one hidden under a rug. But sometimes a block can't be found, and she suspects it might be in a toy box that Dennis refuses to let her open. So she weighs a block, and then by comparing the weight of the box when a block is missing to the weight of the box when she can account for them all, she can infer that the missing block must indeed be in the toy box. On another day, when the dirty water in Dennis's bathtub is slightly elevated, she can measure its volume and conclude that the missing box must be in there, even though she can't see it. Now, Feynman points out that the existence of a constant number representing the totality of energy in the system allows for these calculations. But for Lacan, the key point of Feynman's example lies in his comment, Feynman's comment, "The most remarkable aspect that must be abstracted from this picture is that there are no blocks." Now, for Feynman, this means that energy is not a thing in the same way that a block is. But for Lacan, this comment suggests that this foundational scientific principle requires the concept of something missing. Conservation of energy, and this is now Lacan, conservation of energy is the very condition of scientific thinking. But what does constancy mean here? Is it not simply a question of number? It is not simply a question of number. That means that something that is lack as such, there is no block, is to be found elsewhere in another kind of lack. The scientific object is passage, response, metabolism of the object as lack. Close quote. This abstract notion of the object as missing is the condition of possibility for both thermodynamics and psychoanalysis, for which the object of desire is lost as such. Lacan summarizes the implications of these accounts of the signifier and the object. "Here we are, then, before the following proposition. The subject can only function by being defined as a cut, the object as a lack. Such a structure is necessary for a cut to determine the field, on the one hand, of the subject, as it is necessitated as the subject of science, and, on the other hand, the whole, where there originates a certain style of the object, the only one to be retained, the one which is called the object of science." Now, Lacan first presented his great essay, Science and Truth, which was subsequently published as the final essay of his one great book, Ecrit, as the opening talk of this 1965-66 seminar on the object of psychoanalysis. It also appeared as the first issue of Cahiers pour l'analyse, which is a journal that was edited by philosophy students at the École Normale Supérieure under the auspices of Lacan and Althusser, as well as Foucault, Derrida, Irigaray, Badiou, and many others. The Cahiers called for a scientifically rigorous structuralism based in mathematics as much as linguistics, a structuralism which they saw as opposed to the various modes of humanism, existentialism, and vitalism that had been dominant in French intellectual life since after the war. And although Lacan's essay is a central statement of that call, it resists being reduced to a simple message, persisting in the singularity of its utterances. In this context, Lacan's argument that the subject of science is the subject of the cogito must have been rather shocking. Lacan had spent a good deal of time in the previous 2 years of his seminar rethinking the Cartesian subject, and these ideas crystallized in Science and Truth. Once again, Lacan remarks, Coiré is my guide here. He never says much about Coiré except that he's following Coiré. And the question of the nature of his relationship to Coiré is interesting and complex. So Coiré is my guide here, as the bridge from monotheism to the Cartesian subject and modern science. And Lacan continues, and this is the quote number 6. I took my lead last year from a certain moment of the subject that I considered to be an essential correlate of science, a historically defined moment, the moment Descartes inaugurates that goes by the name of cogito. This correlate, as a moment, is the defile of a rejection of all knowledge, but is nevertheless claimed to establish for the subject a certain anchoring in being. I sustain that this anchoring constitutes the definition of the subject of science. Now, Lacan's commentary on the cogito is really vast and very rich, and I can only make a few comments about it here. First of all, we recall that Descartes reaches his epiphany of subjectivity only as the culmination of a systematic process of doubt, as Lacan says, a rejection of all knowledge. In the process of emptying the world of knowledge by doubting all meaning, whether received or perceived, Descartes establishes the grounds of truth on what he takes as the certainty of being. Although I may doubt everything I have been taught and even what I have seen for myself, the very fact of that doubt is immediate. To doubt it would be simply to confirm it. And just as the fact of the pot is taken as proof of the existence of a potter, so the act of doubting implies that there must be a doubter. So epistemological doubt leads to ontological certainty, anchoring in being, as Lacan puts it, which will serve as the basis, with a little help from God, for Descartes' reconstruction of a new account of scientific knowledge based on the clear and distinct ideas that seem to share in that initial moment of certainty. This new account of knowledge is fundamentally different from classical epistemology. Just as the created world of monotheism opened the door for science through the decompletion of the natural world of Aristotle, so the subject of modern science emerges only through the decompletion of the field of knowledge, which is constituted as such by the kernel of truth that stands outside its field, the remainder left over from radical skepticism. For Lacan, Descartes' declaration, "I think, therefore I am," is not the claim of the identity of thinking and being in a self-conscious, self-identical subject, but must be understood as an utterance, as if the second half of it were in quotation marks, "I think, therefore I am." As the effect of an act of speaking, the subject of the cogito is split into two distinct entities, the I who thinks or speaks and the I who is thought or spoken. The subject of science, thus, is not a unified mental substance, but fundamentally divided. Lacan's reading of the cogito leads him, as he writes, quote, to formulate our experience division as subjects as a division between knowledge and truth, and to accompany it with a topological model, the Möbius strip. This strip conveys the fact that the division in which these two terms come together is not to be derived from a difference in origin, close quote. That's also from Science and Truth. The division of the subject between knowledge and truth is not a distinction between epistemological sources or substances, but functions like a Möbius strip, which may appear to have two sides like a sheet of paper, but in fact is a single-sided surface, a continuous flow of recto and verso. That is, the difference between truth and knowledge is a function of the contingent relationship between any two signifiers. This is the relationship that for Lacan will define the subject itself in his aphorism, a signifier represents a subject for another signifier, and which we've already pointed out to you is the first one on your handout. The first, and actually, let me point out too, that on the last page of your handout, I sort of diagrammed what Lacan calls the master's discourse in terms of that statement, a signifier represents a subject for another signifier. So Lacan's, what he calls the master's discourse is on the left. We could talk about it more later if you really want. But the logic of it is presented on the right. So a signifier, the S1 represents the subject, the barred S, for another signifier, S2. So the first signifier, which Lacan calls S1, derives from Freud's notion of a unary trait, Einzigerzug, the mark of primal repression, that is the condition of all other repressions, hence constitutive of the subject of the unconscious. According to Lacan, this signifier falls out of the symbolic order and becomes intransigent, fossilized in primal repression. That is, it doesn't function as part of the differential movement that characterizes the unconscious chain of signifiers, but constitutes a dead point of non-meaning on which the movement of signification stumbles time and again. And rather than being the product of a subject, this signifier, according to Lacan, is the indication or placeholder of the existence of a subject for another signifier, S2, which stands for the various chains of signifiers that make up a symbolic order. So unlike the sign, which signifies something that is a meaning for another individual, the signifier, according to Lacan, represents someone for something. I don't think I got those quotes quite right. Unlike the sign, which signifies something for someone, right? The signifier signifies someone for something, if that makes sense. So what it signifies is indeed a subject for the other signifiers that make up the symbolic order. Thus, rather than a self-identical individual who uses language as a tool, the subject is the effect of a purely contingent difference between signifiers. We could say that S2 stands for the realm of knowledge for the subject of science, only insofar as it is decompleted by the truth of S1, the pure being of a signifier which has fallen out of the movement of signification. In the 1970s, Lacan returns to the question of the relationship between monotheism, science, and psychoanalysis. In his great Seminar 20, Encore, he again links the emergence of a signifier in the biblical creation with the possibility of modern science. And this is quote 7. Genesis recounts nothing other than the creation from nothing, in effect, of nothing but signifiers. As soon as this creation emerges, it is articulated on the basis of the naming of what is. Isn't that creation in its essence? While Aristotle cannot help but enunciate that if ever there was anything, it had always been there, isn't what is at stake in creationism a creation on the basis of nothing, thus on the basis of a signifier? Isn't that what we find in that which was enunciated as the Copernican Revolution? It is, however, not Copernicus who marks the emergence of modern science for Lacan, but Galileo, as well as Kepler and his account of the elliptical orbit of the planets, and Newton, of course, who explains this gravitational movement in terms of a mathematical formula. Whereas the world of Aristotle and pagan cosmology is eternal and full, the world represented by Genesis is temporal and incomplete. The very fact of the existence of speaking beings, creatures whose first act in the world is to give it names, is the condition of possibility for the formalization of modern science, according to Lacan. The process of mathematical formalization defines the work of psychoanalysis. Lacan continues, nothing seems to better constitute the horizon of analytic discourse than the use made of the letters by mathematics. Close quote. And moreover, Lacan points out that Aristotle's classical epistemology brought with it a kind of an ethics. And this is quote 8. If Aristotle props up his God with the unmoving sphere on the basis of which everyone must pursue his good, it is because that sphere is supposed to know what is good for it. That is what the break introduced by scientific discourse obliges us to do without. There is no need to know why. We no longer have any need for the knowledge Aristotle situates at the origin. In order to explain the effects of gravitation, we don't need to assume the stone knows where it must land. There is, according to analytic discourse, an animal that happens to be endowed with the ability to speak, and who, because he inhabits the signifier, is thus a subject of it. Henceforth, everything is played out for him at the level of fantasy. But this isn't tantamount to the beginnings of a cosmology. Psychoanalysis, insofar as it derives its very possibility from the discourse of science, is not a cosmology. So, if earlier in his work, language meant first of all speech and the division of the subject between utterance and statement, as in Lacan's reading of the Cogito, now it's language as writing that is of primary interest to Lacan. Writing is epitomized by mathematics. If Lacan's earlier thinking can be characterized by the expression, again, a signifier represents a subject for another signifier, it's increasingly supplemented in the 1970s by the aphorism, there is no such thing as a sexual relationship. And writing is precisely what conceals the lack of a sexual relationship, as Lacan remarks in Seminar 19, quote, the essential function of the fact of language is to fill everything that is left gaping by the fact that there can be no sexual relationship, which means that no writing can take account of it in a satisfying fashion, close quote. And if earlier Lacan had understood the subject of science in terms of the Cartesian cogito, increasingly science for Lacan means mathematics, primarily set theory and topology. And the impossibility of a sexual relationship will be expressed in terms of mathematical formulas of sexuation. Of course, we should not understand Lacan in this strange statement to be making the claim that people don't have sex, which would be absurd. We can think of it rather as a corollary to the earlier proposition. The divided subject that emerges as the difference between two signifiers is constituted according to one of two possible configurations, named man and woman, which are two different modes of self-division. For Lacan, what Freud calls castration is the constitution of the subject between two signifiers. Men and women are alienated from their bodies by the mediation of language, which, in the process of giving them access to a shared symbolic order, also denies them any direct, unmediated experience of corporeal jouissance. What Lacan calls the phallus is the mark of this castration, and what he calls phallic jouissance is the residual enjoyment that language also grants us some limited access to after its radical loss through the subjectifying effect of castration. To enter into subjectivity through language is to be deprived of the fullness of animal existence. But there are two modes of castration, two ways in which language configures a subject as a man or a woman. And these two modes are asymmetrical and incommensurable with each other, not reciprocal or complementary. Hence, no direct relationship between the subjects who hold those positions is possible. It should go without saying that for Lacan, these two sexual positions have nothing to do with biological gender. A woman can inhabit a male body, and a man can just as easily inhabit the body of a female. Nor do they have anything to do with object choices, homosexual or heterosexual. But what does the lack of a sexual relationship have to do with science? Another way Lacan explains the assertion that there's no such thing as a sexual relationship is as the claim that the relationship of men and women cannot be written or formalized, which is to say that no adequate symbolic articulation of the sexual encounter is possible. This is the argument that the human animal struggles to make sense of sexuality, to put it into words and images, but can never succeed in that effort at representation insofar as its constitution as a subject by means of words and images is precisely what prevents it from inhabiting its sexuality as an immediate experience. To paraphrase Hegel, the mystery of human sexuality is a mystery to human beings themselves. This concept of the impossibility of a sexual relationship comes to define Lacan's developing concept of the real. If in his earlier work Lacan understood the real first as the facts of personal history, or as what Freud called psychic reality, which attempts to represent and reconcile internal and external affect, later Lacan associates the real with the impossibility of any such reconciliation, as a topographically indeterminate stimulus that is traumatically in excess of symbolization. And finally, Lacan comes to see this impossibility of representation as that of the sexual relationship. As Lacan remarks in his seminar 19, with the strange title, Ou Pire, it is the very practice of the sexual relationship that there is affirmed the bond of the impossible and the real that we promote, we as speaking beings. There is no other attestation of the real. What we have to be suspicious of in all reality is that it might be phantasmatic. And what allows us to escape from the fantasy of reality is an impossibility in the symbolic formula that we are able to extract from it, which demonstrates there the real. So for Lacan, our experience of reality is intrinsically untrustworthy, prone to all manner of distortion, not only because of the specular constitution of the ego installs us within an imaginary order of false resemblances and coherence, but because what we call reality itself is phantasmatic, that is, based on the fundamental fantasy that shields us from encountering the lack in the symbolic order, the disjunction between S1 and S2. Hence, if we are to confront the real, it will not be by debunking reality as imaginary or ideological in the sense of a false image, but by facing the inconsistency of the symbolic order, the impossibility, finally, of formalizing the sexual relationship. And what would be the aim of science if not, in fact, to approach the real, which is what Lacan is suggesting here. Finally, for Lacan, the great act of monotheism is its interruption of what he describes as the essence of pagan cosmology, its belief in a sexual relationship, a world organized by reciprocal male and female principles such as earth and sky, matter and spirit. As Lacan remarks in The Ethics of Psychoanalysis, quote, "In that pagan ambience at the time when it was flourishing, the noumen rises up at every step, at the corner of every road, in grottos, at crossroads. It weaves human experience together, and we can still see traces of it in a great many fields. That is something that contrasts greatly with the monotheistic profession of faith." Close quote. So in purging the world of its animism, its belief in gods who copulate with human beings and spirits that inhabit nature, monotheism is asserting the real, the lack of a sexual relationship, which will become the fundamental principle of psychoanalytic science. And increasingly, this will define science as such for Lacan. He notes the shift in emphasis in his seminar Encore. "There was a time when one could, not without reason, assure oneself that scientific discourse was grounded in the Galilean turning point. I have stressed that enough to assume that some of you have gone back to the sources, I mean to Coiré's work. On the one hand, scientific discourse has engendered all sorts of instruments that we must qualify as gadgets. On the other hand, and here there's no link up, there is a subversion of knowledge, connaissance. prior to that, no knowledge was conceived that did not participate in the fantasy of an inscription of the sexual link. Let us simply consider the terms active and passive, for example, that dominate everything that was cogitated regarding the relationship between form and matter, a relationship that was so fundamental and to which each of Plato's steps refers, and then Aristotle's, concerning the nature of things. It is visible and palpable that their statements are based only on a fantasy by which they try to make up for what can in no way be said, namely the sexual relationship. So science is itself divided. On the one hand, it aspires to approach and formalize the real. On the other, it produces an endless series of gadgets, such as contemporary media technologies and social networks that reinforce the illusion of relationship. But despite its instrumentalization in technology, the fundamental principle of science is the subversion of knowledge. That is, the critique of knowledge as connaissance, which in French indicates something like familiarity, and needs to be distinguished from the knowledge that analysis produces, which Lacan always refers to as savoir. The subversion of connaissance is the work of Cartesian doubt, which defamiliarizes the world for the sake of establishing a new certainty, if you will. At this point in Lacan's thinking, however, it's not formalization alone that makes psychoanalysis a science, which, even when understood in terms of the differential signifier, formalization that is, still remains uncomfortably close to the assumption that it is possible for science to fully symbolize the world. Kant already sensed that this was a problematic assumption, although, of course, the concept of the noumenal merely displaces the problem. But modern mathematics addresses it directly in, for example, Gödel's incompleteness theorems and Russell's paradox of the set of all sets that don't include themselves. For the later Lacan, psychoanalytic formalization approaches the real insofar as it fails, as he says in Encore, and this is quote 11, "The real can only be inscribed on the basis of an impasse in formalization. That is why I thought I could provide a model of it using mathematical formalization, inasmuch as it is the most advanced elaboration we have by which to produce signifierness. The mathematical formalization of signifierness runs counter to meaning." For Lacan, the science of psychoanalysis involves, on the one hand, the production of mathemes that formalize its knowledge in the purest, most condensed, and most transmissible form of writing possible. On the other hand, it's only when formalization fails, reaches an impasse, that it can encounter the real that cannot be written, the lack of a sexual relationship. And this is the point when psychoanalysis becomes not only a model of knowledge, but an act, an intervention with the possibility of therapeutic value. For Freud, too, the limited power of understanding was always a problem. As he soon discovered, the knowledge produced by psychoanalysis, both its theoretical account of the structures of neurosis and its interpretations of particular dreams and symptoms, does not in itself affect subjective transformation. The unconscious easily accommodates the most perspicacious of interpretations into the networks of signification that shelter its fundamental fantasy, which is remarkably resistant to change. Freud continued to seek techniques that would break through this analytic impotence, including his developing ideas about the nature of transference and his late attempt to distinguish the analytic work of construction, I referred to earlier, which is a kind of fictional narrative produced, if you will, ex nihilo, from the interminable work of interpretation. For Lacan, psychoanalytic theory cannot be secured against the inevitability of the signifier's drift. Both his followers and critics alike will fill the gap of the impossibility of the sexual relationship with meaning. That will be, in the terms of his seminar, worse than the impossibility than that impossibility itself. The language of mathematics, insofar as the signifier on which it is based, carries with it the nothing introduced into the world by monotheism in its inaugural break from a sexually unified cosmology, is the best chance psychoanalysis has to preserve its essential knowledge. The little letters, as Lacan calls it, that psychoanalysis borrows from mathematics to write its savoir, are addressed to a future that we can only hope will know how to read them. And if not, at least we'll pass them on intact. Now, this account of Lacan's math themes may seem to cast the formulas of psychoanalysis as a sort of revelation, if you will. But if so, we should recall that revelation by itself is not enough to transform a people. Moses seems to encounter such an impasse in formalization, if you will, when he brings the divine law down from Mount Sinai, only to find that his brother Aaron has reestablished the fundamental fantasy of paganism in the shape of the golden calf. Moses responds to this impasse in the most shocking of acts, smashing the tablets of the law themselves, the very symbolic structures obscured by the Israelites' relapse into the imaginary pleasures of idolatry. For Lacan, formalization and math themes allow psychoanalysis to produce an integrally transmissible knowledge. But formalization also inevitably leads to impasses where it founders against the rock of the real. And it is precisely at those points of impasse where what Lacan calls the pass becomes possible. The pass as the psychoanalytic act where the structure of fantasy that supports reality is itself shifted, or in Lacan's expression, traversed, exposing new aspects of the real and new ways of encountering the lack of a sexual relationship. Now, although psychoanalytic science can only have developed out of monotheism, Lacan's relationship to religion is complex and ambivalent. On the one hand, monotheism enacts the break from what he calls cosmology, the belief in a universe that is unified, totalized, and organized into reciprocal gendered principles such as form and matter. Monotheism introduces into that decompleted world the condition of possibility for the signifier, the subject, and the object, thereby establishing openings onto modern science and psychoanalysis, which both attempt to encounter and expose, in their own ways, the fabric of the real. On the other hand, in a 1974 interview entitled The Triumph of Religion, Lacan presents religion as the antagonist of science and psychoanalysis, insofar as it is the ultimate meaning-making machine, able to absorb whatever traumatic real emerges through science and to integrate it into the new account of the divine plan. Lacan argues that this is precisely what modern science and psychoanalysis are not trying to do. Their work is not to find meaning in the real, but on the contrary, to strip away all projections of meaning in order to reveal it without any assumptions about its reason or its end. Science and psychoanalysis, Lacan remarks, introduce, quote, all kinds of distressing things into each person's life, close quote. Bits of the real that challenge our desire for meaning, our residual primitive belief that the world is a balanced and orderly cosmos. Religion, on the other hand, attempts to find purpose in every threatening novelty that emerges. Quote, since the beginning, religion has been all about giving meaning to things that previously were natural. Religion is going to give meaning to the oddest experiments, the very ones that scientists themselves are just beginning to become anxious about. It will find correspondences between everything and everything else. That's its very function, close quote. Psychoanalysis must also be vigilant about its own tendencies to give up on Freud's discoveries. A tendency for Lacan represented primarily by the Chicago School of ego psychology, which he relentlessly criticizes in his work in the 1950s. Lacan is by no means convinced that psychoanalysis and science will prevail in their battles with religion over the real. For now, there is still psychoanalysis, but Lacan comments darkly, quote, you will see that humanity will be cured of psychoanalysis. By drowning the symptom in meaning, in religious meaning, naturally, people will manage to repress it, close quote. Science is the ally of psychoanalysis in this gigantomachia with religion. But science can easily slip into mere technicity, the production of gadgets that, as Heidegger also argues, keep the real at a distance. And because of this propensity of religion and technical science to give up on or actively repress the real, psychoanalysis insists on the distinction between encountering the real and symbolizing it. Freud's evident commitment to science seemed to assure his followers that psychoanalysis was simply the next stage in a history of civilization that was moving inexorably from the imaginary beliefs of religion to the increasingly precise realism of modern science. But over the course of his long career, Lacan reread Freud with extraordinary attention to what Freud actually wrote, and discovered there things that many of Freud's followers thought he surely could not possibly mean. Like Freud, Lacan knew that psychoanalysis needed to confront religion, science, and philosophy. But for Lacan, it was less evident what might come out of those encounters. The relationships that would emerge always risked obscuring more fundamental differences and antagonisms. Nevertheless, it is precisely in the impasses of its relationships with religion, science, and philosophy that psychoanalysis has the best chance of opening a pass into something new. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by UCLA Associate Professor Kenneth Reinhardt. Professor Reinhardt's lecture was titled Psychoanalysis and the Monotheistic Origins of Modern Science and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was David Eckel, Boston University Professor of Religion and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.